rising up out of the grave. It's The Walking Dead Week in Review, episode 47.
This is Mike from Evolution of the Apocalypse, and when I'm not out putting a bullet in a zombie's brain, I'm listening to The Walking Dead Week in Review with Jason, Jeff, and Mike.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of The Walking Dead Week in Review. I'm Jason, he's Jeff, and we call her Casey, because that's her name. It's Casey.
And it's episode 48.
Is it 48? I thought it was 47. You're right, it is 48. I even have that written down, and I said it wrong.
Episode 48, the epic episode 48, and the epic episodes from here on out until the season reconvenes.
So I want to let everybody know, and you guys know, that next week for The Walking Dead Week in Review, I will have the guys from AOE, Evolution of the Apocalypse, or no, that would be EOA. I'm dyslexic. Evidently, I can't read. I'm dyslexic, and I should probably just go right now. But
not only are you dyslexic, but you're dyslexic, too.
I have to look that up, so I'm not going to confirm or deny that. But with that, yes, from the Evolution of the Apocalypse, and we are going to be talking about our zombie survival guide of what we saw from the first half of this season. So it'll be a top five from the three of us. And Jeff, you're welcome to join us if you want. But it'll be our top five survival tips. And just to make things a little interesting, because, you know, three people, top five, that's 15, and we like to talk. It's going to take a little while. So what it's going to happen is you're going to have to listen to Evolution of the Apocalypse to hear the first half of our zombie survival guide, and then come back here and listen to us for the second half.
Okay.
Nice little cross promotion there.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? You know, they're great friends of the show, and I think this is great for both of us, for both podcasts, because we cover a lot of the same material. So, you know, rather than having one super 2-hour long show on one, we'll just have it on both. And also, I want to let you guys know to get a hold of us, give us a call, 503-454-6941, to leave a message on our listener feedback hotline. You can also leave us a voice message by going to creepercast.com and clicking on the little pop-up or the thing in the left-hand side that says leave a message. We can also be emailed by going to or emailing us at feedback@creepercast.com. We're on Facebook and Twitter. And Jeff, why don't you tell them about the iTunes sweepstakes?
The iTunes sweepstakes is where you can leave us reviews on The Walking Dead Week in Review or on our parent show, The Creepercast. As soon as we get 25 reviews on our iTunes pages, then we will draw from the proverbial perverted hat, as Jason likes to refer to it as, and one person from each group of reviews will receive their pick of one item out of our Creepercast swag store.
That's right. And I want to mention some of the reviews that we have gotten already. One comes from Friggin' Italian, who has listened to us for a while now. And he said, great podcast on a great show. I usually watch the show twice to catch all of the nuances. Then I listen to the podcast, and yet these guys still manage to point out things I've missed. Love listening to the show. Thank you, Friggin' Italian, and I still love your name, by the way.
Yeah, you Friggin' Italian.
This next one is kind of a rip on Jeff. So, Jeff, take this with a grain of sugar.
Sugar. cube of salt.
Beavis and Butthead, this comes from Jones85. I'm only about 6 minutes into this podcast, and it is just, and is it just me, or are y'all high on weed? Y'all laugh at everything that's mentioned, even if it's not that funny or funny at all. It's really kind of annoying, and the main host caps this off by laughing just like Butthead from the old MTV days. Wow. Seems like a decent podcast. Just please stop with the uncalled for laughing. It's kind of weird. Thanks. Keep up the good work. I love how, you know, with that and then ends it. But Jones, I want to thank you for writing in. Even though you ripped on Jeff, you will be put into the proverbial hat.
And actually, we can debate whether or not he was ripping on me or you, because we don't know what episode he listened to. And you technically are the main host.
I am the main host. But
so unless he was listening to a show that you were missing from. So that means, so at least we are assuming he's talking about me, because we've already had, you know, somebody send us that wonderful 3.5 minute laugh cast.
I can't even do the butthead laugh. I guess I could be Beavis. I can't do that either.
Oh, and the only real response that I have is that, you know, more proof as to basically the whole grain of salt or grain of sugar thing that you mentioned at the beginning is the whole time you were reading that, you laughed in between everything he said, and there was nothing funny about what he said.
Okay.
So there's just proof that we take everything with a grain of sugar. It's like you just insulted us and we laughed.
Well, he did say that we're high on weed. If only it was weed.
Yes, it's something far worse than that.
That's
I'm into slow-mo myself. Everything's going really slow.
I think maybe he was talking about Casey, because Casey, we know that she's always laughing.
And she is the main host.
Yes.
Am I? When am I getting my paycheck?
As soon as we get ours.
Paycheck? Wait, there's money in this?
All right. What's this next, next one comes from Cobra Mike. LG or IG? I can never tell with capital letters. But he puts 5 stars. Love the podcast. It's like listening to your friends talk about the show. I love it. And
I love it too, because that means his friends are Beavis and Butthead.
No, that's a different.
Oh, okay.
You can't connect the two. It's that's kind of how we wanted it. And then the last one comes from Al Krim, and he put Shaw. I listened to about 5 or 6 different Walking Dead podcasts, and I really enjoy what you guys have to say. I'm so happy you guys are going back to review the season between the mid-season break. I think it's awesome you guys are doing this, because besides 1 or 2 other podcasts, there is no other way to get my Walking Dead fix. Keep up the great work, guys. Hey, thank you, Al. You know, this is really our Walking Dead fix.
Yeah, for the most part. Because it makes us watch the episodes again and talk about them again.
Well, and it's great. We mentioned this many times that, you know, when your initial reaction after the show, you don't tend to see the nuances or the stuff that you see when you rewatch it. And especially when you get the background info from people like Robert Kirkman and Frank Mazzara and all that stuff.
And it's good to know that people appreciate us doing this.
Oh, definitely.
Going back
especially the going back part, because, you know, in all honesty, the going back sometimes feels a little tedious, and it's good to know that we're being appreciated for it. And much like I believe you said, it was Al, is that, you know, we need to get our fix in between too. We don't want to be sitting here being stagnant, and we're glad other people are, you know, feeling the same way we are.
Yeah. Now, it's hard for us to do this all through summer, but, you know, at least the break is long enough that, you know, we can fill it with stuff when we can. Obviously, we've taken a couple breaks in there thanks to the holidays. But I think with that, why don't we head into, we've got a two-part episode with this, where we're going to cover 2 actual Walking Dead episodes. We're going to go over episode 3, Walk With Me, and episode 4, Killer Within. Mind you, that was the definite killer episode, in my opinion, still the best episode of the series.
Yes.
Definitely the most emotional.
Oh, yeah. All right, so let's go into Walk With Me. So Walk With Me, what's interesting about Walk With Me is this is the first episode in the entire series that we don't see Rick.
That's true.
That Andrew Lincoln is not in this episode. He got to go on vacation that week, or weeks, however long it is. But it is an Andrea and Michonne episode. We also get introduced to the governor in this episode, who is... Okay, I'm going to start off with the, you know, before we jump ahead and actually get into the synopsis. The first time that I watch this, I'm thinking, you know, the governor, he's such a creepy guy. He's, you know, such an evil dude, evil everything. But now when I really watch it again, all he really is a politician.
Right. Well, and I've been saying that all along, is that especially in this episode, you don't, until the end of this episode anyway, you don't really get the impression he's that creepy of a guy. He's just really good at playing politics.
Yeah. That's all he really is. He's just a general politician that, you know, he's learned how to manipulate people. And what's up with the tea?
The what?
The tea.
The tea.
The tea that
likes tea. Oh.
Evidently, that is like that tea's got to have like some you know, GHB in it or something.
he's trying to make himself into a socialite.
Okay. You don't know what I'm talking about. The episode starts off with a military helicopter crashing into the forest, and three soldiers are on board. Andrea and Michonne spot the wreckage from the distance, and they go to investigate. As they go up to the helicopter, vehicles are approaching and force them to hide. And what's great about this is now that they're hiding, you see the vehicles approach, you're thinking, what the hell is happening?
Yep.
And then the other thing you're thinking is, is this the same helicopter?
From the beginning? From the very beginning?
Yeah, from last season. Because last season, you know, they were following a helicopter and then switch when they hear the shot from...
When we actually saw the helicopter crash, too. I mean, at least we saw an explosion from the helicopter going down.
Last season.
That was... Yeah, okay.
Last season. So this is 9 months later.
Yeah.
And so,
are you talking about the helicopter that Rick saw?
Well, Rick saw one in season one,
right? Which was never explained,
right?
And there was one in season two.
And then at the end of season two, all the zombies or all the walkers before they head to the farm, they're following a helicopter. And then they hear the gunshot from Carl shooting.
Shane.
Yeah. So I'm wondering if this helicopter is the same one from that one, you know, the same military group.
Oh, yeah.
We don't actually know either. It was never explained to any extent. I kind of hope it's not, because that seemed kind of silly that I guess they could tie it together 9 months later kind of thing. But what I think is the most important part about it is that we now know that there is an active military. We just haven't really seen much of them except for in this episode where we know it was the crash from the end of season two. At least we're assuming, right?
Well, this is not this can't be the crash.
No, it can't be. That's right.
No, this is 9 months later. Yeah. Mm. So, you know, but could the one at the end of season two be the same helicopter that Rick saw in season one?
Does that matter?
Yes. Yes, damn it, it matters.
I think the only thing that matters at this point is that we know that there's an active military.
Okay.
Somewhere.
The question, we know there's an active military, but the question is are they communicating with each other? Are they just little, are they, you know, people that have kind of been in the military but got stranded? And so it's not a full active military, it's just military groups.
Okay. So maybe the chopper's just been trying to fly around and find other military people.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. Okay. It's possible. I mean, we're making a lot of guesses here.
Absolutely. All right. Michonne's pets are rattling their chains, drawing the men's attention. So what does Michonne do? Just decapitates them like it was nothing.
And isn't this the first time that we really get introduced to Michonne? Like at the end of season two, we only saw her in like shadow.
Right. And then the last episode, or the first episode, should I say, all we really saw of Michonne was when, you know, the little interaction that we got from for picking up the aspirin and bringing it back to Andrea.
When Andrea was sick, and that's pretty much all we got from that episode.
Right. This one, we actually dive a little bit deeper, and not so much into Michonne's past or know anything about her, but at least what her personality is.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is kind of stoic.
Yeah, stoic. Yeah. She's a badass. We'll just put it like that. She'll kill her own pets in order to stay safe.
And then also in this episode, right as soon as she does that, they're also discovered by who other than Merle Dixon, who is now sporting a bayonet prosthetic.
Sweet.
Andrea sees him and passes out.
And why wouldn't she? I mean, she just saw Merle.
That would be the oh shit moment.
Yeah. I think anybody who saw Michael Rooker would probably just pass out. I mean, if I was walking into a store and he was walking out, I'd just drop.
Especially with a bayonet on his hand.
Yeah, right.
She does wake up blindfolded a couple times in the car. And overhears a group leader's driving instructions via CB radio. And then passes out again. And she sees the car approach a massive wooden gate, i.e. heading into Woodbury. In an unfamiliar room, a doctor is administering an IV to Andrea as Michonne watches. Merle joins them and recounts the story of his escape from Atlanta, saying he nearly bled to death after sawing his hand off. Andrea says his brother Daryl tried to find him and was still alive when she last saw him months ago. But it wasn't, the thing is it wasn't just his brother that looked for him. Everybody went back, including T-Dog.
Yeah, yeah.
Everybody he doesn't even care. He's still bitter.
Oh, yeah, I know. And I can understand from his point of view why he would be bitter, but at the same time, it's one of these that, you know, it's, yes, that happened, but they still went back. It's not like they just left him and said, you know what, screw you, Merle. We don't like you anyway, racist pig.
Well, they did say that at first, but...
Well, yeah, they did.
And I guess that says a lot about Merle, that he still can't get past his anger, even knowing that T-Dog, of all people, went back for him.
Yeah, I don't know too many people, though, that chained to a rooftop with zombies or walkers busting through the door are going to be very forgiving right away.
Yeah, I think that'd be a little bit hard to earn the forgiveness.
Yeah, I mean, you would take that into consideration.
But at the same time, it's also... But at the same time, what happened with T-Dog was also just, an accident. He didn't mean to. It's not like he went and, said, haha, here's the keys. I'm dropping it down the hole. It was like he was running back to unhook him, and he tripped and it fell down. And at that point, what do you do?
Yeah. Well.
Yeah, I just felt like he didn't give it enough consideration. It was just like, screw that. I still hate you.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's Merle for you.
I don't know. Most people, I think, would say, oh, okay, I guess I could, they'd be a little more.
I think I would, with the exception of, Merle kind of took it to an extreme, though, I think, cutting his hand off. I mean, we don't know exactly how close the walkers were to getting through. But
yeah,
you have to be pretty desperate to, go trapped animal on yourself.
But since he is pretty much an animal, it makes sense that you would do the trapped animal thing to me. And he would be considering the fact that it's not just the walkers trying to bust through the door he's got to worry about. I mean, how long can he last being chained to a pipe?
Being chained to a pipe, if they don't come through, figure he's going to, water is going to be his thing. He could last in that sun, in the summer of Atlanta, maybe 2 days.
So I don't know. I just think we are talking about, giving Merle a lot more credit than what the guy has ever proven he deserves.
That's true.
Especially for thinking wise, is that you're saying that he's going to think all this through? It's like, no, he's not. He got slighted, and that's all he noted. That's all he remembers.
Right. And then other thing is also, cauterize the damn hand.
Which we discovered, which we learned later, though, isn't a good first move.
No, but you know what? It's better than bleeding to death. Take the chance of infection over bleeding. All right, so then we get to meet the group's leader, the governor, as he arrives quietly and confers with Merle. Michonne demands her weapon back, which tends to be a trend in this episode.
Which becomes her motto.
Yes. The governor assures her they're free to leave the next day, at which point their weapons will be returned. When Andrea asks why he knifed the dead soldier, the governor explains that anyone who dies turns into a walker. I put them out of her misery, he says. Now, this is something that we talked about the end of last season, is what do you do when someone dies? Now. And so, obviously...
Make sure they're dead.
Yeah, the governor and stuff, they made a protocol that anybody that dies, whether they were bitten or not...
Well, until the end of season two, we didn't know that everybody was going to turn, regardless. So, and what we've learned from the governor is that this is something he figured out by experience.
Yeah. So the governor then escorts Andrea and Michonne out to reveal a peaceful, torch-lit street that says, "Welcome to Woodbury."
Welcome to Pleasantville.
Yeah, that's what it looks like. It's Pleasantville. It's Mayberry. Yep. Taking them to, although Mayberry with a lot of armed guards. Andrea marvels at, as the guards, led by Merle, take out three approaching walkers. Because, you know, she's now Annie freaking Oakley.
Yeah, yeah.
The governor shows them to the room where fresh clothes are laid out. Michonne is visibly skeptical, especially when the governor tells them one of his men will be stationed just outside. Now, this brings up the big question. How naive is Andrea to all this? Because obviously Michonne figured it out right away. That something doesn't smell right in Woodbury.
I don't know that she figured it out. I don't think anybody else besides her would be so suspicious so fast. It seemed like she came into it being suspicious.
True. I would have been just as suspicious as soon as they took my weapons away.
Yeah, and wouldn't.
Yeah, he had a reason for that, though. I mean, they don't know them, so they could be just as dangerous.
Right. I mean, Rick did the same thing. And really, a lot of the stuff that the governor does, hasn't Rick done?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, with the exception of, you know, keeping heads in a jar and... You know,
yeah,
that's next for Rick.
Attempting to rape people.
We won't get into that episode yet, but he didn't actually rape her though. And he didn't really attempt it either.
Yeah.
He acted like he was going to.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's for another show.
We know about the comics. Yeah.
True.
All right. The next day, Woodbury resident takes Andrea and Michonne on a tour. Children are happily roaming the streets as people go about their business. The guide says that 73 people live in the town and that there has not been a casualty since winter, thanks in part to the governor's strict curfew. Now, here's my question. What does a curfew have to do with anything? Like, do the walkers mainly come out at night? Did they talk about that somewhere?
That's actually an interesting point because they...
That's from the first episode, isn't it? Where they talked about that they're more active at night?
Yeah, that they are more active at night, but how does a curfew affect that is a good question. Because there's still guards on the walls, and even if the walkers are more active at night, how... I mean, unless there's people running around in the streets, what difference is it going to make? So maybe that's what they're assuming, is that if there's people running around in the streets in the middle of the night, then that's going to attract the walkers, and then the guys up on the wall, they're going to have to, you know, be shooting more often. But it is interesting that the credit is given to the governor's curfew when really it's about the, you know, the army that the governor has set up.
Yeah, that's true.
When the curfew is just where the curfew is basically just a method by which he controls the townspeople. Politician, yeah. Yet again, more proof of how good he is as a politician,
i.e. Coming up with a solution that doesn't really have a problem,
right? Yes, we know how government works.
Yes. It's hard not getting political in this episode.
Well, and that's why he's called the governor.
Yeah,
because this is a very political, he's a very political person
figure.
There you go.
All right. Meanwhile, the governor visits, is it Wells? Is that what his, how he, mm-hmm. Yeah, Wells.
The pilot?
The pilot.
Yeah.
The badly injured pilot. Wells reveals that he left 10 men behind so he could scout ahead, and the governor wants to know where they are. He says, I'll promise. If they're still alive, I'll bring them here. Yeah, right. So this is where, you know, there was only 10 men. Therefore, I don't think that that's 10 men, them two, that's too small to be a platoon.
Yeah.
So what I'm thinking is that...
I think they're scraps of military trying to
regain. Exactly. That's exactly what they
and
are.
That's pretty much the way they acted at the end of the episode, so...
And didn't they say that a bunch of them just abandoned their post and ran? They probably just gathered whoever they could.
Yeah. Basically, most of them were deserters, which is probably why they're still alive and, you know, everyone else is walking. The governor goes to his advisor, Milton, to his lab where he finds him and Merle arguing. The governor chastises them and then orders Merle to go learn more about Andrea. Alone, the governor and Milton study the still living heads of Michonne's pets. Milton remarks that Michonne removed their arms and jaws, take away their ability to eat. They lose interest in doing so, he noted, explaining that the neutered walkers acted as a repellent. Now, I love this. This kind of goes back to Guts right here.
Yeah. It's also foreshadowing, too, and I didn't realize that until, you know, you just said all that, is that it's foreshadowing to the pit. Because yes. All the walkers in the pit were jawless.
I didn't even realize that they were jawless.
The walkers in the pit were jawless?
I didn't think they were jawless.
I'm pretty sure. When we get to the episode, we'll definitely have to double check that, but I'm pretty sure they were... Because I was thinking, like, what is the point of the walkers being around the people while they're in the pit? Because they looked like they were jawless to me. But we will double check that. Or people can tell us.
Yes.
How stupid I am. And that I laugh. And that I laugh like Butthead. Anyway.
Later, Milton joins the governor for breakfast with Andrea and Michonne. Oh, this is where we get to the whole tea part. You know, because the governor... When he's talking to Milton, Milton says, you only come down here for my tea. And then they get back to here where they're having breakfast with Andrea and Michonne. Milton explains the series that the walker retain a trace of the person they once were and asking about her pets. You did know them, didn't you? Michonne stays quiet. Of course she did. But speaking only to demand the return of her weapons. And the governor urges them to rest for a while. And again, throughout breakfast, two or three times, he asked about the tea. What is up with this freaking tea? Now, on The Talking Dead, Greg Mazzaro was saying that, I think it was him, had to do with one of the writers. That they were kind of teasing him because he... Like he always had a cup of tea with him. But I mean, there has to be something special inside that tea. Like, is it made with weed?
It's got morphine in it. Yeah, there you go.
Like I don't know. It does. I don't know much about drugs.
It could be like
can
an
you,
opiate.
Can you like get
well, you make
high
tea,
off
you
of
can make tea off, you can a lot of opiates began as tea.
Okay.
So Like opium itself was actually a tea before it became, you know, opium that we know and love today.
Well, coca tea.
Yeah, coca was a tea. So maybe it's along that line. Maybe there is some type of a drug. Coca would actually make sense that certain people would be, like the governor would want to be awake most of the time, I would think.
And that's
gotta
what Sigmund
he's gotta
Freud
be a,
drank a lot.
Yeah, he's got to be a pretty paranoid guy if you think about it.
Yeah.
That tea is just extra delicious, that's all.
And Milton is great company. I mean, come on.
I like Milton. I don't know why, but I like Milton.
There's just something about him that is both annoying and awesome.
All right.
Not a very good scientist, though.
Well, he's making it up as he goes along.
Well, you know, the thing is, you have to remember that what he's doing with almost nothing.
Yeah. And he has none of the foreknowledge that we have. With the CDC involvement or anything. He's like trying to figure it all out from nothing.
Yeah. So after breakfast, Michonne declares her mistrust of the governor, but Andrea wants to stay in Woodbury. Picking up on Milton's query, Andrea asks Michonne about her pets. Those walkers that were with us all winter long protecting us, she says, and you took them out without any hesitation. It was easier than you think, Michonne responds, storming off. You think she still has some animosity towards her ex-boyfriend? Is that some domestic violence going on there?
There's really no way of knowing what she's thinking.
Well, and they didn't make that a major focus either. So,
yeah,
just that. I mean, obviously, it might even be a certain level of foreshadowing again, though. I mean, she took out her boyfriend and his best bud without second thought, even though she was keeping them around because they were her quote unquote pets and protection and all this other stuff. So let's look at the governor and how quickly she was able to erase.
Well, I think it extends even further in the fact that she's willing to take out anybody that could potentially kill her.
Well, and when they're walkers, that's one thing though.
Right.
Where she hasn't pulled a Shane yet.
Yeah, but she has proven that she can be ruthless when she needs to be.
Yeah.
It is kind of funny that the whole conversation that Andrea was having with her about how they've been traveling for so long and she still doesn't know anything about her. It's like, how can you travel with someone, it's just the two of you for months, and they don't talk to each other? Kind of weird.
No, but this is probably more for Jeff. And it's, I don't know if it was just in this episode or another episode, but did you kind of get a vibe that they may not have talked very much, but in the months that they were together, you know, they knew each other a little better than we thought? If you get what I'm saying.
Yes, it is kind of implied. And there was many discussion about that after, especially after this episode. There was, you know, many things about Andrea that came out. One of them being, you know, well, what were they doing all this time hanging out if they didn't talk?
Are you really going there?
We could always draw that conclusion. I mean, the other thing that obviously with this episode is this is the one where a lot of people were beginning to think that Andrea was a freaking moron.
Well, didn't she seem like it? Honestly.
Yeah. But remember, and I argued this right from the, you know, the first time we saw the episode, I'm starting to change my opinion because she's getting stupider and stupider the more things are thrown in her face, and I'm thinking it's more of she's going through more of a Florence Nightingale situation rather than, you know, the original situation is
Stockholm
that she was
syndrome,
a lawyer.
Not Florence Nightingale.
Yeah, Stockholm Syndrome. There you go.
this is the second or third time you've done that in this podcast.
Yeah, well, that's what makes it fun. But it's this episode, though, she did seem to have blinders on. But I think with this one, you have to cut her some credit because she is looking at the glass half full and refuses to see it half empty until something proves her otherwise. She's a lawyer. She's got to, you know, assess the situation. As the episodes progressed, she quit being a lawyer and actually picked sides.
Yeah, which is going to make for a very interesting second half of the season.
Yeah.
All right.
I don't know. That always kind of bothered me, that whole idea that she's being stupid.
I don't know if she's so much being stupid, but I don't think she's being stupid.
Yeah,
I mean, she's a lawyer. She survived this long. She's a very intelligent person. But I think that, like Jeff said, she's putting blinders on or she's trying to rationalize things because she's more, I think, in love with the town and the lifestyle than being out on her own, to where Michonne, you know, she went, what it is I think Andrea wants to be a part of the community. She wants to have that group. She doesn't want to be a lone survivor like Michonne does, to where Michonne is actually happier, I think.
Yeah.
Or more content or feels more confident in herself if she is alone and doesn't have to worry about other people.
But Andrea needs to be part of a group. I think that's pretty much obvious. And
that's understandable.
And the fact that she's worked so hard to become part of the group she was in, even though she was being played by another, you know, even though she got sucked into the whole Shane, you know, Shane versus Rick situation, she was always still part of the group and became a very productive part of the group, even though she wanted to erase herself became a very important part of the group. So now she's stuck in this situation where she could either continue to be a loner with Michelle or Michonne, or become another important active group member. And the governor has given her that opportunity.
Right. And, you know, the fact that she has the fixation on the wall and the military aspect of it, that kind of plays right to her, you know, the same thing that it played where she wanted to be on top on the lookout tower and stuff like that. She wants that military group mindset.
Yeah, and she's developing well, even she said it in the later episodes, is that she's developing the hunger for it, the excitement for it. So, you know, she's already going into the baser barbaric instincts.
Well, it's human instinct. Yeah, but it's human instinct to be a part of a tribe.
Right.
You know, going back to the beginning of man, being by yourself meant almost certain death. Being a part of a tribe is what, and I use tribe ubiquitously, not like Native American tribe or, you know, you as a group, being a part of a tribe is meant survival. And so it's very natural. That's why humans are group seeking creatures, are social creatures.
Which would explain also why Michonne even made, you know, Andrea a part of her group, is that she still, you know, struggled for that need to have the companionship and to belong to something, just another side of her, mostly because of the way she's, and we know this because of the comic books, that because of the way she was slated throughout her life, she'd rather be alone. Right. But even in the case of Andrea, she found, you know, she had to connect with somebody. And it's, you know, it's a continuous thing. It's happening, you know. As the story progresses, she ends up doing the same with Rick's crew. So,
all right,
and it's like we've been saying all along. Michonne really hasn't even given her any reason to really be. She hasn't told her anything. She's just given her, you know, her gut feelings. She hasn't said, yeah. "I've seen this. I've seen this." So, you know. I mean, would you just want to go back out into this world that you've been struggling against on just gut instincts?
Well, that's exactly it. And that's where, you know, it's the idea of the rugged individual versus the community. Right. Michonne represents the rugged individual. Andrea represents community.
Which is interesting, again, because that's what Andrea was trying to be, the rugged individual, for a while.
Right.
And ended up getting sucked back into the community. And now she's become, you know, to where she needs the community. And then what we know of Michonne's past, again, it's not in the show, but what we know of Michonne's past is she was always forced into community. So she, you know, withdrew. And that's what takes her outside of community. But the other thing that I think is interesting is you would also think after traveling a certain amount of time with somebody and, you know, getting to know the way they act and what they do and that a lot of their instincts are true and work and everything like that, that why is Andrea questioning her so much at this point, though? Because she's had plenty of time
I think that's the rationalizing that Andrea's doing.
Yeah, okay.
So... I want to jump to the end of this episode because we still have another episode to go over where at that night, the governor looks over Woodbury from his apartment window as he sips a glass of whiskey. Mind you, that's probably a hard to come by commodity. He walks past a naked woman laying in his bed and gazes at a framed photo of his wife and daughter before entering a private room. Inside, he settles onto a chair and stares numbly ahead, where three rows of aquariums are filled with live walker heads, among them Michonne's pets and Wells. So there's been a lot of talk about the heads and how creepy the governor is and everything. But one thing that I find really interesting is the way that this is the governor... finding a way, everybody has to find a way to cope with what's going on outside. And so he finds a way, in my opinion, he's using the heads as a way to desensitize himself.
And that is an excuse he uses later.
Right.
is to remind himself that that's what's outside the walls. You know,
right, but I don't even think it's necessarily to remind him about what's outside the walls. I think he's using it as, or at least at the beginning, maybe. Now he, you know, we don't know. Maybe he gets some sort of weird satisfaction out of it, but he uses it as a means of coping to desensitize. So by constantly exposing yourself to pain, you become, you don't feel it as much later on. You build up a tolerance. And I think that's what he's doing is by looking at all these heads, he builds up this emotional or psychological tolerance to be able to do some of the awful things that he does.
Like murdering those National Guardsmen.
Yeah, exactly. Like yeah, what he does, you know, to Glenn, or you know, I mean, yeah. So I don't know. What do you guys think? Am I off my rocker on this?
Desensitizing, maybe. I mean, everything he does, what I've been noticing, and we've actually discussed before, and I'm not saying that it's good, because if sense of community and you know the welfare of regular humans are to be taken into consideration, then what the governor's doing isn't entirely good. But desensitizing, yes, and not necessarily, like you said, to the group, you know, to what's outside the walls. It's probably more desensitizing to, it makes him harder.
Yeah.
To the fact that then it makes it easier for him to deal with regular humans, maybe. Like the killing off the guardsmen and everything like that, though, and even, you know, what he does afterwards with Maggie and Glenn and everything, those really are cold and calculated political decisions. So, and we talked about it, especially with the guardsmen.
Yes.
Is that, you know, they were a threat, but they had things he needed. So remove the threat and take what they have, and you're that much better off. So I'm not sure exactly, since we don't have a better clear understanding of his background, other than the fact that, you know, his wife obviously died and that he keeps his daughter locked in a closet.
Which we don't find out in this one.
Right, which we don't find out in this one. And that's, again, this is the last couple of things too, which is why I say this episode was very well put together. Based on what we've already talked about, even, is that we get the impression, like you said at the beginning of the show, you get the impression that the governor is a very good politician. Throughout the whole episode, you are given instances as to how he is a great politician. And then you get the last two things that happen are things that are totally against our normal way of thinking as a, you know, as civil human beings. And yet they are still very cold and calculated political moves.
Yeah.
So that's why I find it so interesting, is that he hasn't actually proven himself evil or even really creepy. It's no worse than, you know, the heads in an aquarium are really no worse than Vlad the Impaler putting heads on a stick.
Or Daryl cutting off the ears and making a necklace.
Exactly. To use a better analogy from the show itself.
Any last words, keeping, Casey, before we move on?
No, I'm good.
You're like, I'm not even going to touch this anymore.
I'm not the one to talk to about politics.
All right. We're not talking about politics. We're talking about the politicians.
Yeah. Politicians themselves.
Yeah. I was just thinking that you don't really, when you first start to meet, when you first meet the governor, I guess it's like you're saying, he's a good politician. He kind of puts this face on that makes him look like he's your friend. And then at the end of the episode, you see him doing something so completely ruthless. And it kind of, like, if you're not expecting it, it kind of like hits you in the gut.
Exactly. And that's why, you know, Jeff said that he's a great politician, because, you know, isn't that, you know, going all the way back to the beginning of, you know, politics, I guess, is the whole, you know, shaking babies and kissing hands or something like that.
Shaking babies. Yeah.
But you know, it's one of them things, you know, that you put on that show so that people think you're, you know, cause you know, most people don't judge you necessarily based on the creepy factor of you behind doors. If you know, it's the idea, you know, and look at politics today, and I'm not going to name stuff up, but you know, we can go through the news over the last 20 years about all of the really creepy things that politicians have done, and yet they were loved for it until that came out. And that's really what it is with the governor.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. He just doesn't have anybody investigating him.
Not yet.
And so, well, Michonne well, is. No, but. You know what? Here's a really great example. People loved Hitler.
Yeah.
People loved Hitler. He was very charming. He was, you know, to people's face. They thought that he could be their best friend. But then look at all the creepy and awful things that he did. And including behind his own, behind closed doors, the stuff that, you know, he was. That's really what I'm. Yeah. Am I comparing the governor to Hitler? Yeah. Maybe. I think I am. Okay.
Yeah, let's sounds move like on. It.
Let's move on to the killer within.
Let's move on to the killer within. I'm going to hit a sound effect.
Oh, I want to say one more thing.
Yes.
About that real quick. Considering the fact that Rick wasn't in that episode, I surprisingly liked it quite a lot.
I did too. Yeah. You know what I'm noticing though? The first season, Rick made the episode. By about this season, Rick, honestly, I don't think he needs to be in any episodes. Like, honestly, right now, they could kill Rick off, and I would still love the show.
I wouldn't go to that extreme.
That's where we part ways.
Yeah, I wouldn't go to that extreme, but I do think we can have parallel storylines. Just fine.
I think right now, it would be a shocker if they killed Rick off. But if they killed Rick off and kept the storyline going with Daryl or, you know, somebody else, Maggie and Glenn, but... you know, and they kept it going, I think I would still be okay, because to me, the show isn't about Rick anymore. The show is about what's going on in this environment.
But right.
It's still largely about Rick.
I think it's more what the show has done is the show has definitely made it more than just Rick. It's more about everybody living in this time period. So I get where Jason's coming from with that. To totally eliminate Rick from it, I don't think would be a good idea, because we do know that the show exists because of following Rick around, because of that's what pretty much the comic books do, and because the creator is as involved with the show as he is, I don't see it taking that drastic of a turn.
No, I don't think it ever will. But I mean, if it did it, I don't think I wouldn't drop the show.
No, I don't think I would. I like the idea of the parallel stuff, though. I think I could do more of the parallel kind of thing, like one episode dealing with one group and then another episode dealing with another group. I think they could pull that off easy.
Or do some spinoffs.
Yeah.
The Walking Dead, Glenn style. The Adventures of Glenn and Maggie.
The Adventures of
Glenn. And Judith.
Yeah, I mean, I do like the idea of focusing on more characters. I'm with you there.
Yeah. All right. The Killer Within. This was the probably the most emotional episode I've seen of The Walking Dead, and probably one of the most emotional episodes, I think, of most of television I've seen. This is by far the one that I made the big mistake of Facebooking back and forth with a fan on Facebook and accidentally leaking. Because, you know, Facebook puts whatever you say out to everybody.
Yeah, and I hadn't seen the episode yet.
So, I put it out, and all of a sudden...
You had a lot of haters, didn't you?
Oh, man. The next day, I look online, or I check my email, because I get the, you know, Facebook message emails, and I'm like, holy crap, I got like 25 emails from friends of mine, not on our Facebook page, but personal friends of mine, and it didn't even dawn on me what I had done.
You get flamed badly.
Oh, man. I had people threatening to drop me as a friend. I had people, I'm like, oh, I don't care. Okay, whatever. But still, it's like, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's really hard not to spoil and get spoiled, because you want to talk about the show and you're so excited, but then so many people, you got to really be careful.
Well, and at the same time, you know, my thing, you know, I had one person saying, hey, I live on the West Coast and we don't get it until 9:00. I'm like, no, you get it at the same time as us.
Well, even I spoke up on that one, which I hadn't seen the episode yet because that was a week that I had to miss. But I hadn't seen the episode yet either. But as soon as somebody said that, I live on the West Coast and it hasn't even aired yet, I'm like, yeah, it has. It airs the same time everywhere.
Yeah, I know. And so that's actually my cousin that did that. But yeah, and I'm just like, yes, it has. Well, not on my cable. I'm like, I don't know what kind of cable you have, but maybe you should talk to them then. Because, you know, they AMC airs it nationwide at the same time. But anyway, The Killer Within, episode 4, starts off with an unidentified person scatters a deer carcass in a trail leading up to the prison. As walkers follow the bait, the person then cuts open and breaks open the prison gate, placing the deer's heart in front of it. Elsewhere, the survivors are discussing plans to clear out the prison yard when Axel and Oscar are... new parolees, can we call them?
Yeah, sure.
Begging to join the group. T-Dog's in favor of letting them in, but Rick, being the cop he is, insists they'll keep their cell block. Coming from a background in law enforcement, I can seriously see where Rick is coming from. It's the whole once you're a criminal, you're always a criminal, don't trust kind of background. It that's something that even in the apocalypse, I think it would be hard for me to dismiss.
Well, and as we've proven later that, you know, in the case of Oscar, maybe he didn't deserve to be typecasted that quickly, but yeah. Axel is proven to be creepier, you know, is proving to be creepy enough.
Yeah, Mr. I only got in here because of pharmaceuticals. Yeah, sure you did. Hate to tell you, but you were probably the guy in the shower.
Probably. With the pharmaceutical shower.
We'll go with that one.
He hasn't done anything except hit on the girls. He hasn't really done anything too creepy.
I don't know. The way he hit on her.
Yeah, you know, to go, interesting. Yeah. 17. Interesting.
Yeah, the way that he said that, just kind of... You know, now I know in most states that's, you know, legal, but still.
That's true. And in Georgia, it might be.
I don't know the laws in Georgia.
Meanwhile, back at the prison, or are we going to go with Michonne and Woodbury?
We're going to go over to Michonne and Woodbury, okay. Where she is inspects the salvaged National Guard trucks and notices bullet holes and blood. She questions the governor about the circumstances and the soldier's death. And he dodges her suspicions and tries to convince her and Andrea to stay in Woodbury. Again, politician. He doesn't even answer the question. He, like, does this awesome tap dance around it.
Yeah.
And he's trying to charm her by saying, we could use a soldier like you, you know, trying to draw her in.
Yeah. You know, which is flattery.
Your sword.
On most people, flattery would work great.
We could use a soldier like you, but you can't have your sword.
Yeah, we want you as a soldier, but you know that weapon that you're so proficient at and works so well for you? Yeah, you can't have it.
Yeah, pretty much.
Back at the prison, Rick instructs Glenn to give Axel and Oscar a week's worth of supplies and sends them away. Axel tries to...
Ingratiate,
thank you.
Himself with Daryl. In other words, he's trying to make buddies with Daryl.
Yeah, basically. See, why couldn't they just say that?
That Axel tries to be Daryl's buddy by offering to tune his motorcycles.
Yes. Which Daryl pulls a
governor and ignores him.
Yeah.
And Oscar just shakes his head disgustedly.
Meanwhile, Beth and Lori help Herschel hobble out of his cell on crutches. Because he heals fast.
Everybody cheers.
He heals really fast.
Yeah.
Let's see. In their, what's that?
That is TV. What can you do?
In the room. I think this is the part where I got the Michonne and Andrea, you know, together kind of deal. In their room, Michonne and Andrea discuss plans to head for the coast. After leaving Woodbury, I'd rather take my chances out there than stay here, Michonne declares, because your gut tells you there's something off about this place and about the governor, Andrea asks. Once again, you know, it's this whole, it's this whole mind versus, you know, or the rational mind versus instinct. Which one is correct? And I think what I love about this is a struggle that most people have with a lot of different circumstances, and they really did a great job personifying it.
I think what's interesting, though, is that it sounds like even you are one of those that believe that gut instinct is not controlled by rationality. When I do think that Michonne has a rationality, she's looking, because she's viewing things and just going, no, I don't like this. Like what I mentioned, that's the reason why I brought up what I did earlier, is when we were talking about the governor convinces Michonne that we could use a soldier like you. And then I made the comment, but you can't have your sword. That's what Michonne is hearing.
Right.
And so she is rationalizing. But
that's true, too.
Anyway.
All right. As Rick and the others clear the yard, Lori and Carl escort Herschel outside. The group rejoices at Herschel's recovery, but soon interrupted by walkers, which have infiltrated the courtyard. Gunfire erupts as Rick races to join the fight. Herschel and Beth lock themselves inside of a fence in the entryway, while Maggie, Lori, and Carl flee into the cell block. I also want to add here that there is a big, loud speaker going off.
Yeah, the alarm.
So that's drawing even more people.
More walkers, yeah.
More walkers.
And this is one of the saddest moments. One of the saddest moments comes next. T-Dog.
Yes, while resealing the courtyard gate, T-Dog gets bit in the shoulder. Huh.
Moment of silence for T-Dog.
Yes.
Meanwhile, back in Woodbury.
Evidently not that long of a moment of silence.
Hey, it's The Walking Dead.
Andrea shows...
That thing took a big, nasty chunk out of his arm, too.
Oh, yeah.
Why didn't they just cut his shoulder off?
Yeah, it worked so well for Herschel. Yeah.
Andrea shows Merle the location of Herschel's farm so he can look for Daryl. When she declines to offer to join, he remarks that they were both abandoned and then rescued by the same group. Okay. Andrea asks Merle if the governor is a good man. And this is when he says, I wasn't in the best shape when he found me. He should have kept on going. He's a good man. So we have this, and then in the last episode, we also have the governor referring to Merle as the hammer. And so it's really weird how they got together and what the relationship is.
Yeah. Well, it's an obviously strong dynamic. I mean, we're kind of looking at what Caesar and Mark Antony, so to speak. Is that Caesar was a good politician and Mark Antony was a great, you know, a great soldier. And that's kind of the way the governor was kind of seeing the situation, was that Merle could be a great soldier. And that's why he, you know, healed, you know, helped him heal and everything like that, and made him into his right hand man, so to speak. And since Merle doesn't have a right hand, you know.
Well, but he's, you know, like I said, you know, being referred to as the hammer, basically, you know, he turned him into an enforcer.
Yeah.
He's a thug. Merle is the governor's thug. So yeah. If we're going with 1930s politics.
It does make you wonder what he saw in Merle to pick this almost dead guy up off the street and take him with him.
Yeah. When
he has no compunction about, you know, killing whoever gets in his way.
You know, why not, you know, let the soldier survive and become another thug? I mean, you know, why choose Merle over anybody?
I don't know. The best analogy I could think of is it's kind of like why people want wolves for dogs.
I don't know, I mean, but I do.
He's going to be your, you know, a wolf is going to be your greatest protector, and he could be your worst enemy. And I think I mentioned this before, is that, you know, the old saying, keep your friends close and your enemies closer. He's making a friend out of him, and he sees him as a possible, you know, the governor sees Merle as a friend and a possible enemy. So keep him as close as possible.
I wonder if he also keeps him around because he could use him as a scapegoat like he will at the
end. Yeah, exactly.
He makes a great scapegoat.
More foreshadowing. Oh, my God.
Yes. Over in the prison yard, Glenn reports that someone cut the gate open. When Axel and Oscar approach, Rick rescues them, but then the prison's alarm sounds and attracts
them.
Accuses them.
Those are two different words.
Accuses. Attracts even more walkers to the fence. Oscar explains the backup generators must be powering on, proving that someone else is messing things up. So, and then of course they have to go and disable them. So, the backup generators, they have backup generators, which means they have power.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder how long the power, like, I couldn't imagine that they ran the generators for very long. The backup generators, at least. So, I mean, just the fact that now they have a form of power, they could, that prison just became the Hilton to them.
Yeah, that's for sure.
I mean, outside of the fact that, you know, Laurie died, T-Dog died, there's dead walkers everywhere.
But it totally explains why, you know, Rick is willing to fight so hard for it.
You know, they've got...
They give blood.
Well, they've got a huge supply of food. They've got a big open yard that's fenced to be able to garden and do stuff outside. They've got water, thanks to the idea that T-Dog had of channeling water in. And they've got power?
Yeah.
I mean... Yeah. I'm amazed, actually, though, that Rick didn't try searching for the generators. You would know that a prison would have generators.
Yeah.
Maybe that was next on his list. They were kind of busy.
Yeah.
With everything else.
Oh,
he's just checking things off.
Yeah.
All right.
He whips out his notebook.
I don't recall if they do they have any lights on, like in their cell block. It seemed pretty dark all the way through.
Yeah, they were always using natural lighting.
Yeah. Or candles or whatever they had with them for torches, flashlights. Speaking of wandering through the hallways, Carol offers to do whatever is necessary to help T-Dog with his bite, but he insists on guiding her back to the cell block. Lori, Carl, and Maggie are also wandering the prison when Lori doubles over in pain. The baby is coming, she says. Carl leads them into the boiler room. Yes, this is where things start getting real, people. Meanwhile, Merle asks the governor, we're back over in Woodbury. Merle asks the governor for permission to go search for Daryl. And the governor says he can't risk losing him on a wild goose chase, but agrees to let him go if he can obtain more concrete information, i.e. beat the shit out of Michonne to try to get something. Because, you know, the governor doesn't want him to touch Andrea.
Yeah, I thought he was just putting him off. He had no intention of letting him go.
Yeah, but think about that from Merle's point of view. How does Merle think to get more information? Merle doesn't only knows of one way. And it would actually be Andrea.
He'd physically beat one of the girls?
Merle?
Information?
Yeah. Merle? Absolutely. You think he hasn't done it before the apocalypse?
I don't know.
Didn't have to do with information? I mean, this guy's a scumbag. I'm not going to say that he's a scumbag that isn't also, a woman beater. I can't say wife beater because I don't know if he was ever married, but, you know, a DV. Jeff?
I don't know.
Sorry, I was MIA for a moment.
Well, we were talking about Merle beating women.
Beating women. Why, he didn't beat a woman in this episode, did he?
Oh my God, you really went MIA, didn't you? Did you just have like a mini stroke?
Maybe. I might be a walker now.
He had one of the mini strokes where he doesn't actually like convulse or anything, or not stroke, mini seizures where he doesn't convulse. He just kind of stares off into space for 2 minutes and then comes back.
Yeah. That's what happened. Really? It wasn't because I jumped up and ran to the bathroom.
No, we were talking about the governor saying, you know, basically telling Merle to get more concrete information before going after his brother. And, you know, don't you think that in Merle's mind, that would mean beating it out of the girls?
Huh. I hadn't actually put it to that extreme.
And then that's when Casey jumped in and said, you know, he wouldn't do that. And I'm like, well, I'm going to assume, this is just me assuming on Merle, that he did it long before the apocalypse even came.
You know, I don't get the impression because, you know, we're given this idea that Merle is a redneck, you know, lowlife, that I don't get the idea that him slapping a woman down is something he's never done before. Yeah. Now, as far as torturing a woman, maybe not. But I could definitely see, like, if a girl got up in his face, he'd be more than happy to slap her down. So.
Probably the same one that, you know, gave him the VD that he needs the meds for.
He probably smacked her a couple of times.
Yeah.
But, so, like, beating Michonne like he beat Glenn, I don't know if I'd see that. Not even someone like Merle.
I don't know. I guess it depends what he wants out of it.
But you think that the governor was giving him the sign to go for that?
No, but I think in Merle's mind, that's what it was.
Wouldn't
if somebody said get more information before you go after him, wouldn't that mean interrogate them some more?
I think it might mean send like a tracker, you know, some trackers out or something, rather than going himself. You know, send some red shirts. to go make
because,
sure.
Because of the 77 people at Woodbury, they have a lot of red shirts. All right. Back in cell
block. The Star Trek Enterprise only had 252 people, and they always had a red shirt.
But that's because they had replicators. They replicated red shirts. Back at the cell block, Rick, Daryl, and Glenn, Axel, and Oscar separate into teams to look for the others and shut down the backup generators. In the boiler room, Maggie is helping Lori get ready to deliver the baby. But as Lori pushes through her contractions, she begins to hemorrhage. Yeah.
Oh, poor Lori.
Yeah.
This is where I get to say I told you so.
I know.
We're going to feel bad for Lori before they knock her off.
And once again, this is one of them that, you know, I hated her. And now, you know, when this happened, I'm like, I feel so bad for her. And then I look back, and as I rewatch, now with having the feelings of, you know, of not hating her, I'm like, wow, Lori really did try. Like, I was so blinded by my hatred for her that I thought everything that Lori did was just her being a bitch. But now, when I look at it,
I tried arguing the opposite side, and you were just dead set on the nope, Lori is the devil.
It wasn't the devil, maybe the devil's bride. No, that would make Rick the devil. Never mind.
Yeah, exactly. And Rick's not getting up to devil standard, that's for sure.
But you know,
it's nice that you got a little more perspective on her.
That's the thing. Rewatching this, I completely changed what I thought about Lori after this. And then it made, you know, the first couple episodes with her, like, really feel for her and be like, she really, really was trying. That's the thing. And so a lot of this is even Rick's fault for not, you know, allowing this. It's like, man, you wish that there was, you know, of all these people, wasn't any of them a psychiatrist? Family well,
Herschel
counselor.
Herschel was like the next thing to everything, you know, medical. So
I know, you know,
he tried and nobody would listen to him most of the time. So,
you know, somebody that didn't Carol watch Dr. Phil at all, you know, couldn't she help out?
You would think, but then again, she came out of an abusive relationship. So plus just lost her daughter, you know,
flirting with Daryl.
Like, yeah, I mean, Obviously, she has psychological problems.
Are you kidding me? I'd flirt with Daryl given the chance.
I knew you'd say that. I knew you'd say that. That's why I opened the door up.
In the apocalypse, me and Daryl, we're tight.
You're like Andrea and Michonne.
We're like Andrea and Michonne. I'm okay. I'll even take bottom.
I noticed a lack of comments from one side of the country.
That just went really, really weird. Casey's not even willing to jump in.
On that note.
Right. T-Dog and Carol.
All right. T-Dog and Carol.
Oh, you know what? When I watched that part where T-Dog died, when he ran up those... Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, T-Dog and Carol, they're in the laundry room.
We're at that spot right now.
Yeah, they're in the laundry room. They're being blocked by walkers, and they're also out of ammo, and T-Dog charges them and urges Carol to keep on going. She reaches the door but looks back in horror as the walkers tear T-Dog apart.
Even though I've seen it, like, I don't know how many times, I still cover my eyes because it's so horrible to watch. I'm being eaten alive.
You know, to me, going from a storytelling point of view, what I feel the worst for is that at least everybody else, like, he went out as a hero, which I like, but everybody else before they went out, they had, like, this nice, epic transition or this nice, you know, epic storyline. Like, Dale had this storyline that all but revolved around him. T-Dog didn't get that.
It was just ripped apart.
Yeah, it was like he was always just there. Nobody, you know, he was like almost like, you know, just a background person that was always there. And then he gets ripped apart and he's gone. And it's like, and so for that, I'm kind of more mad that we didn't get more of a T-Dog storyline before he died.
Yeah, I feel like that too.
A continued struggle anyway, of some sort. I get where you're talking about with that, but then I listened to what you just said, which is because he was always kind of the background person, and then all of a sudden he just got ripped apart and he's gone. Isn't that like, don't you miss the background person more when that happens?
Not really.
Because they were kind of like robbed from you. Because you didn't get the little extra stuff. And I think that's kind of what they were working with when they were writing the story, is that... Okay, T-Dog's usually in the background. He comes to the front every once in a while. So when he dies, if we just rip him apart and suddenly he's gone,
yeah. But I mean, look at Dale last season. Dale, you know, he was always just kind of a background person. Closure. And then the very last episode where, you know, he does die, the episode revolved. It didn't revolve around him, but it had him in a lot of it where he's, you know, going around trying to, you know, convince people to take his side, and, you know, so it followed him around. So you got this, it's like, you know, so you had that buildup that you weren't sure what they were going to do. And then when they finally killed him, you're like, all right, T-Dog, it was like, and you went out a hero, but who cares?
I don't think it was a who cares. I think it's more of a, you know, absence. The absence aspect is that once he's gone, you're going to realize just how important he was. And just because they gave everybody else this epic death scene or whatever, and then they just basically took him out of the equation. So I think for the rest of the season, we're going to be spending a lot of time talking about, crap, there's no T-Dog. Actually, what we're going to be talking about for the rest of this season is all these other people who are trying to step up and be T-Dog.
Well, that's the other thing that we're going to have to talk about, because, you know, after T-Dog left, then they had, not Oscar, who's the other guy?
Yeah, not Oscar.
Axel.
No, Oscar is the one you were talking
about. Oh, Oscar. Okay. And so they had Oscar kind of step up and, you know, not to put race into this, but basically be, you know, the token, the big black man in there. Right. You know, T-Dog's gone. Let's put him in there. And then they kill him off.
Then they wiped him out without any ceremony at all.
Right, exactly. And so that was kind of the problem that I had with this, is that, you know, I don't think T-Dog, and I don't think the actor, and I need to look it up real quick because I can't say his name without looking at it, you know, had a full chance at, you know, having a good out.
is Iron E, by the way.
Iron E, that's
he
it.
He got a good exit. He just didn't have a good story lead enough to it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think he died the way he lived in the show. I mean, there was real no difference between his death and the way he lived in the show. It was an epic death. Everybody's going to mourn it. Everybody's going to mourn it. And you didn't get, you didn't get the long outro like you did with Dale or even with Shane. But, it's like, but that's the way T-Dog has always been a part of this show, is that he wasn't epic or he wasn't like, as much as I hate to say it is that he was very much a fixture. And what they did is they just took the fixture away. So it's kind of like walking into a room.
So he's a lamp.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It's like, the trusty lamp, the lamp that you know that if you walk over and flip that switch, it's going to turn on. Okay? That's what T-Dog is, for lack of a better analogy. And now you're going to walk into the room and that lamp is gone. Like, you're not going to miss it. It's the trusty lamp that always turns on.
It's the blankie. It's your blankie.
Yeah.
Your blankie's that's what T-Dog always there.
So I think he's going to, I consider him more, it kind of makes it more poignant to me as a, from a writing aspect. Because he went out as he was a part of the show, and because we always expect to see him, and now we're looking at all these other people going, oh, is this the new T-Dog? Is this the new T-Dog? And none of them are going to measure up because they're not the same lamp.
Not the, it's the same lamp.
It's,
I
love that. It's a messed up psychology, but it's true.
That should be the name of this episode, not the same lamp.
There we go.
And I have to say, the whole controversy with the T-Dog dying and then Oscar dying, the whole race thing, I never bought into that. I don't think it really has anything to do with race.
No, it's not really.
Unfortunate timing.
Yeah, it's, well, I wouldn't even say it's unfortunate timing. It's definitely a coincidence that is hard to, as fans of anything, horror or science fiction based, is because, like I keep making the red shirt comment, if you so it goes all the way back to Star Trek and then beyond, is that so it's not just race. I mean, just because they're black men doesn't really mean anything. It's because they're wearing the white shirt or the red shirt. that's why Star Trek tried to erase the whole concept of race, is by putting everybody in a red shirt instead of, saying that it's the black guy, it's the Asian, it's the whatever. It's just whoever's wearing a red shirt.
Well, no, but I see where Casey's coming from, because that was especially online a lot. And I don't know if Iron E. Singleton or what's the name of the guy that plays Oscar? I think the guy that plays Oscar is the one that actually brought it up on Twitter or something, that there was a racial motivation there. I don't think there was any motivation to doing that. I think it was just written in such a way that, it perceived it that way. But at the same time, it's hard to look at it and go,
right,
and say, well, T-Dog,
it seems too coincidental.
The only African-American on the show dies, coincidentally, just as another one comes on. This guy dies, coincidentally, just as another one comes on.
Yeah. But then as fans of the show and as critics of things like that, you automatically jump to that conclusion. Is it, it's racially motivated. That doesn't necessarily mean it is. I mean, it's at least with the situation of Oscar, I think he was expected to be a bit character right from the start.
And he was. And that's the thing, is they always knew that Oscar was a bit part.
So in that case, it really is coincidence. And the fact that they bring in a new black man, well, I can't speak for today, but in the 70s and 80s, it would have been racially motivated.
Right. I mean, I always, especially when it comes to stuff like, when it comes to stuff like this, I always assume the best. I always assume that it wasn't. But at the same time, that was definitely one of the big news cycles debates going on at the time.
Which is really too bad, because the most important part of this episode is that Andrea and Governor share a parting drink in his apartment.
So, any last things before
segue?
Yes.
And he reveals that his name is Philip.
Yes, the governor is Governor Philip,
which is also the name of an emperor and a king, by the way, and three kings actually.
and his wife died in a car accident before the apocalypse. Before Andrea leaves, the governor tells her that she can return to Woodbury anytime. Rick and Oscar and Daryl reach the generator room where they find Andrew still that alive somehow. Wow, he must be freaking fast.
So here we go. The killer within is literally the killer within the prison.
That guy was crazy.
Like, how? I think that's still the biggest question is how did Andrew get through all of that?
Especially when he was basically the most cowardice, you know, the most cowardly person out of all of them.
Noel, you have to remember the way that Andrew is, though. Andrew is the type of person that knows when that retreats and plans. He's an, you know, he's an ambush fighter. He's not a stand in the field and, you know, fight in the open. He's a, I'm going to retreat, come back and fight another day, but we're going to do it on my terms. Yes. And that's exactly what he did.
And probably people underestimate him because he's so small. You don't expect him to.
Maybe that's
to
how
come
he,
back at you the way he does.
Maybe that's how he got out. He crawled underneath all their legs. It was kind of like in that cartoon, in like the old Bugs Bunny cartoons where everybody piles up and then Bugs Bunny like crawls out from the bottom.
Yeah, yeah.
And like going back to the beginning, like we know that with Andrew at the beginning. You saw how he learned pretty quickly how to handle walkers. He was leading them into the prison.
Yeah. Well, and so, he was the one. Was he the one? Now I have to think of my timeline. Would he have been the one watching? Yeah. Carol do the surgery.
Yeah. Because that would have been the end of last episode, which by then we thought he was dead.
Yeah.
We made the assumption he was dead.
Yeah. And any sane person would take their act on the road and try to survive instead of, you know, coming back to get revenge. This crazy elaborate revenge.
Well, he's not stupid either, though. He knows he's got a maid there. So he just get rid of Rick and, you know, and the rest of them, and the place is his.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's a place I want to live alone. I'd have
Well, maybe
nightmares.
He assumed that the other prisoners, though, maybe he assumed that Axel and Oscar were going to take him back with arms wide open kind of thing.
And you notice that they didn't put it into Oscar and Axel's yard. No, they did, because they had to flee themselves.
Yeah, it was all of them. Yeah.
So it was all of them.
It was the entire prison that got flooded with walkers.
Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't a real well thought out plan because he attracted all those walkers into the cell block. If he killed off Rick and everyone else, he'd still have walkers to deal with.
Now, if he was able to get his hands on a sniper rifle, that would have been the way to do it. All right. So, yes, they reach the generator. Andrew and Rick struggle. Oscar picks up Rick's gun. Andrew urges him to shoot Rick, but Oscar shoots Andrew instead, then returns the gun. Rick powers down the generator. Yay! Until we go back into the boiler room. Boo!
Back in the boiler room.
Lori grows faint as the hemorrhaging continues. I'm not losing my baby, she tells Maggie. You've got to cut me open. Mind you, this is after trying to have her stand up to deliver. And the whole time I'm just thinking about, you know, rewatching this, I'm thinking about what has to be going through Carl's mind right now. Like, you know, he's watching all of this happen. How do you stay level-headed like he did?
So Chandler Riggs, if you're listening.
Yes, honestly, I want to know what's going through Carl's mind. If I get a chance to see him, hopefully I'm going to try to make it to the Horror Hound weekend in Ohio in March. And if I'm able to make it, the Walking Dead cast is there, and I will ask Chandler that question.
He seemed pretty freaked out to me. All through the birth and delivery.
Are you kidding me? He was about as level-headed as you could get.
He was a rock.
I mean, yeah, he was freaked out.
He was screaming I don't know.
Well, that's true. He
didn't
actually
look level-headed. He looked like...
No, there were moments where he was screaming at, you know, he was screaming at Maggie and trying to figure out
what are you doing
to
her? You know?
Yeah.
Like that.
Well, and he was definitely confused.
There like a rock.
You know,
it wasn't until at the end when he decided he had to shoot her that he kind of like put this cold mask over his face. But up until then, he was pretty emotional, I thought.
See, I saw, the way that I saw it was that he was emotional, yes, but he was pretty level-headed as far as emotional. Like, he didn't break down and, you know, go hide somewhere. Like, honestly, if I was his age and that was happening to in front of me, I would have turned my back and I would have, you know, ran and hid somewhere and not watched.
He was brave. I'll give you that. He was brave to stay there. And, well, Maggie told him, you know, are you ready to help me deliver your brother or sister? So I think he kind of, you know, had to, like, steal himself as much as he
was like, no.
especially not understanding, you know, how, you know, it works as far as hemorrhaging and, you know, complications with pregnancies go. You know, all he knows is what's wrong with my mom. Why isn't it coming out? As far as I knew, you know, she pushes and the thing shoots out and I catch it with a glove or something.
Yeah, I think there was a lot more of that going on, is that he didn't understand the situation. And so, yes, he was, you know, he was like, hey, shouldn't there be a baby by now? I mean, Carl's already proven that he's not great on patience. So he's very simple. I mean, he's like, okay, mom's pregnant. She's going to have a baby. I want to see a baby. Wait, there's no baby. What's going on? Why is she screaming? And then it ends with, you know, and then when he realizes she's dead, there's blood everywhere. His final thing is okay, we can't just leave her here. She's going to turn. You know, I mean,
talk about a fast sort of delivery. My wife was in labor for half a day. I've heard
that was a C-section, though. I mean, this
but I mean, when they really had her stand up and try pushing.
Yeah. Yeah, good point.
I mean, the contractions, it's like no contractions, and now they're, you know, half a second apart. Let's see. Back at Woodbury, Andrea tells Michonne she wants to stay longer. Michonne storms out. Lori, tearfully, said, this is after, you know, the cut me open scene. We already kind of talked about that. Lori tearfully says goodbye to Carl. Don't let the world spoil you, she says. You're the best thing I ever did. That was a touching moment. Yeah, that made me, you know, the hardest part about this, watching this episode, is that, honestly, I wanted to just, like, run into my son's room and pick him up and hold him, but both him and my wife were at her mom's, so he wasn't around for me to grab him. Otherwise, if he was there, I would have said, I know I'm going to wake him up, but I don't care. I'm going to pick him up and hold him.
That's a lot of people said that after watching this, is that it just made you want to go hug your children.
All right. And then Maggie slices Lori's belly open, scoops out the baby. The baby survives, but Lori lays motionless. Blood is pouring out of her open wound. And that's when Carl says, we can't just leave her here. She'll turn. Maggie leaves with the baby as Carl hugs his mom. Moments later, outside the room, Maggie hears the gunshot. Outside, this is another hard part. Outside, Rick, Daryl, and Glenn reunite. We have that happy moment. You know, and you notice that The Walking Dead really does a great job. Anytime that they're
finding happy and sad moments, yes.
Well, it's always a happy moment before, bang, we're just going to completely pull the rug out from under you.
I wouldn't have called that a happy moment.
Well,
they just found out. They just found T-Dog's body, and they still didn't know where the other ones were.
But you had that kind of happy moment where, you know, they're all standing outside, and Maggie and Carl come with the baby before Rick realizes that his wife isn't around.
Yeah, that was a happy sad. I mean, yeah. That was a definite contradiction of feelings going on, because you see the baby and it's like, you know, you saw the look of like, whoa, the baby's here, you know, happiness. And then the realization that Lori's not with them, you know, comes across his face and it's instant grief.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. 1 second of happiness.
Babies cause happiness. Everybody knows this. Until the first time you change the diaper, the baby causes happiness.
I don't mind changing the diaper. It's now that my son has figured out how to crawl out of his crib and we can't get him to go to bed. So with that, I mean, that's the two episodes that we went over. This was...
we took a little bit longer than we intended.
Yeah, we were intending on doing this in a half hour, but, you know, then we got onto tangents.
We spent too much time arguing.
We did.
Arguing and pointing out psychology and things like that, which is what... But that's apparently people
it's what
like
we
that.
Do.
You know what we need to do? Do any of you guys, do either of you, are you friends with any psychologists?
No, not me.
No, I've never actually considered that. I know some counselors, but...
We should, that's a goal, Jeff, me and you. We need to find a psychologist or psychiatrist, whichever one...
Yeah, we need a shrink.
Whichever one doesn't give drugs. to come on and talk about the psychology of living in a world like this.
That would be awesome, actually.
That would be good. I'd like
put
to
the
hear
word
that.
Out on that one.
Yeah. So anybody that listens, if you studied psychology, if you have a doctorate, I don't care if you have an associate's in it, and you want to come on, we'd love to have you on to talk about the psychology of living in a post-apocalyptic world.
Definitely. We'd definitely like to talk about that psychology, just like we would like a psychologist or psychiatrist or whichever to explain to us the psychology that AMC is going through when they let showrunners go from The Walking Dead all the time.
Yes, tell me about that.
Well, it appears that Kirkman is actively involved in this decision, and maybe it's because Glenn Mazzara hasn't quite come to the same way of thinking that Kirkman is, although I'm not sure Kirkman knows which way he's thinking these days, but Glenn Mazzara has been released from The Walking Dead. It happened apparently, well, I guess the releasing happened fairly recently, but it was all based on the fact that the last half of season 3, which we were anxiously awaiting for, was way behind schedule in shooting. They were going over budget after having the budget cut a few thousand times, and Kirkman decided that Mazzara doesn't have the same vision for the show that he does. So they let Mazzara go. One of my main concerns about the Mazzara loss is that, I spoke out against the Darabont loss because I think Darabont is a visionary in most projects he works on.
Oh yeah, definitely.
he always comes out as the visionary, and even though I understand of budget constraints and such, I think that if it wasn't for the way he crafted season 1, that the show probably wouldn't have progressed as well as it has. Now, when Mazzara took over, Mazzara became the figurehead for the show. I mean, he wasn't just showrunner. He was, publicist. He wrote. He directed episodes. He did so much for the show. He became – him and Kirkman were the figurehead. Now what – what kind of a show can we look forward to now that Mazzara is not a part of it? And obviously, they haven't named a new showrunner yet. I'm hoping that Kirkman's not going to try to run the show himself. He's a comic book writer. And granted, he may have learned something in the last 4 years about how to put together a good television show, but being an expert like Darabont or Mazzara, I guess the truth will be seen in the next couple of seasons.
Yeah. Yeah, I was very depressed when I found out. Not depressed, but disappointed.
Disappointed is the better word because I was really... I was kind of depressed when Darabont got released, but then I see that Darabont's still, doing just fine, and he gets credit and paid and all that for what he has done. But Mazzara, like I said, I mean, that guy was a tireless promoter.
Oh, yeah.
And I just cannot understand how they can just, especially when the blame, so to speak, has been put on Kirkman. It's like, but these guys have been working together nonstop. I mean, maybe they had a falling out is what ended up happening.
Yeah.
Is probably more likely the case. But, Kirkman has to either become his own promoter again, or we'll find out, I guess, who else steps in.
Yep. All right. Any last things you want to say, Jeff or Casey, before we hit the music?
No. It was... good couple of episodes. It was fun to revisit them.
Yeah. Next week, don't forget, we're going to have the guys, Mike and Matt, from Evolution of the Apocalypse on, where we will talk about our top 5, 15, theoretically, between the three of us, zombie survival tips based on the first half of the season. So don't miss that. You hear the first half by going to evolutionoftheapocalypse.com and the second half by coming here to the CreeperCast. All right, and now it's time for the music. All right, and also don't forget to get a hold of us by giving us a call at 503-454-6941. Send feedback to feedback@creepercast.com or head over to our website and leave comments and leave voicemails on our website. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/creepercast and on Twitter at twitter.com/creepercast. And of course, leave comments in iTunes by, well, you're probably subscribed through iTunes, so just go there and leave us a comment. Share the love, and when we hit 25 people, we'll put your name in my proverbial hat to choose your to get your choice of any one thing out of the CreeperCast swag store. Casey, you're already in it, aren't you?
Yeah, I am. So I hope I win.
You're already in the running. All right. Thank you guys for joining me. We'll see you later.
Night.
Good night. See you there.
See ya.
Thank you for listening to my uncle's podcast.